Good morning. This is Focus, Hour 2 of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. And Kyle Mabry was on for Hour Number 1. In the early days of the space program, most people thought that the spacesuits that astronauts would wear would be rather like the rockets that they flew in. In fact, you look at some of the early designs, some of the early ideas made spacesuits look kind of like suits of armor. The thing is, though, those designs failed time after time. These early designs were really not successful, and success only came when the approach changed from hard to soft, and it was accomplished with the help of seamstresses taken from the shop floor of Playtex, the bra and girdle company. In this hour of Focus, we'll hear about how the worlds of science and fashion came together to create a key component of the space program. And our guest is Nicholas DeMoncho. He is assistant professor of architecture at the University of California at Berkeley, and he is the author of a book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is Spacesuit Fashioning Apollo. It is published by MIT Press. You can find it out in the bookstore now. It is a beautifully made book, has lots of wonderful photographs. I'm sure it would be interesting to people who are interested in the space program, but also interested in the history of technology and in design. So I would suggest you should take a look at it. And we're happy to have the author as our guest this morning on the program to talk about fashioning Apollo. As we do, questions welcome, 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And Nicholas DeMoncho, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us. I am completely fascinated and captivated by this subject, and it almost surprises me a little bit. Maybe the big selling point was when I was looking at the book and saw the Playtex angle, which I suppose it grabs everybody, I guess.
Well, you kind of couldn't make it up. Which a pretty remarkable story, and one that I was pretty surprised that no one had dug very deeply into before.
Yeah, and also I do again want to say what a beautifully made and wonderful book it is, just as an object. And I think I'd better ask you, I'm prompted to ask you, just tell us about the book jacket.
Oh, well, the book jacket is that famous photograph of Buzz Aldrin standing in the A7L spacesuit on the surface of the moon, but the black background standing in for the inky backdrop of space is actually black neoprene and latex, which is the very same material that's hiding underneath all those white outer layers of the suits that Playtex was so expert in working with that led to their success in the suit design.
Yeah, well, congratulations to the book designer. And also, it's interesting that the spacesuit itself, I'm sure we'll talk some more about this, it actually has 21 layers, and your book has 21 chapters.
That's right. I'm a stickler for recapitulating. But actually, the actual spacesuit itself, by the end of the Apollo missions, by Apollo 17, those layers had expanded to 29. But I chose to stick to 21, since that seemed like more than enough chapters for the book.
And all of the suits that were worn by the astronauts in the Apollo program, and all the suits that were worn by the men who walked on the moon, they were all made by these women who work for Playtex.
Absolutely. Well, I should make the sort of corporate lineage is slightly complicated, but the Playtex started out just as a brand name, like Kleenex or something like that, for this company called the International Latex Corporation that was founded by a Russian immigrant in upstate New York in the 1920s. Originally, they marketed diaper covers for babies, which is where the play in Playtex came from. And then by the during the Second World War, the company, which had been very successful in marketing the first rubber girdles for women just before the Second World War, they had a really tough time of it, and without any government contracts during the war. And so this impresario immigrant, Abram Spinel, funded what he called a government and industrial division, which is really just a little office in the factory in Delaware that made the famous silver tubes that Playtex girdles were sold in, as well as the metal racks that supplied them in stores. Mm-hmm. So it was this small government and industrial division that got the contract in a rather remarkable way for the spacesuit in 1962, and then later spun off to form a company called ILC Dover, which makes, in fact, shuttle suits to this very day.
Yeah, and here I think it's there really was early on here a real competition between different companies and different approaches to solving the problem. And it turned out that the reason that this division of Playtex and this approach worked, got the job, was that that was the thing that worked.
Yes, and it was an intense competition. You can imagine the everyone knew, even in the early 1960s, what an incredible exercise, public cultural exercise this would be, and companies were crawling over each other to especially to equip these heroic astronauts who, as they walked on the surface of the moon. Interestingly enough, the first approach that was proposed to NASA was not actually for the astronauts to wear suits at all, but rather for the astronauts' own bodies to be kind of re-engineered with pumps and valves and silver skin to go on the moon. And this is that's actually the origin of the word cyborg. It was invented as a name for this proposal as to how man could be remade to walk on the moon.
And
that, of course, didn't quite fly. But the kind of approach that underlies the cyborg approach, that is to say that the body is just another part of this big, enormous machine. The machine that brought us to the moon was the most complicated machine that had ever been made up until that time in human history.
Yeah.
And so the approach that the spacesuit should be machine-like was very much the kind of assumption on the part of NASA and its engineers. And but interestingly enough, in 1962, when the kind of request for proposals for the Apollo spacesuit went out, this was a spacesuit that, unlike the suits of the Mercury and early Gemini missions, wasn't just a backup in case the pressure in the space capsule was lost, but it was in fact the astronaut's sole environment out on the surface of the moon. So it was a much more complicated enterprise. And the only really successful suit offered in 1962 came from this tiny division of a company that most people knew for women's underwear. And therefore, even NASA didn't quite think that they knew the suit was good, but they didn't quite think that that ILC, the International Latex Corporation, could handle all of the enormous bureaucracy and paperwork and systems engineering of this larger process. So initially they were paired with another company, and one of their competitors, and that in the end was a very forced marriage and didn't work out. And by 1965, ILC had been fired by NASA and then managed to work its way back into the a kind of remarkable six-week competition that took place between ILC, its erstwhile collaborator and now competitor, Hamilton Standard, and the company that had made the Gemini spacesuits. And it was this competition that really won ILC the contract, and after which it became the prime, as they say, prime contractor for the Apollo spacesuits.
Yeah.
Their victory was rather dramatic, with a lot of rather hilarious stories involved as well.
Well, I think, you know, among the many great facets of this story is the way that even today the astronauts feel about their suits. You know, you would think here these men would become attached to the equipment that they used, maybe the craft that they flew in. But that apparently the thing that really means most to them, and perhaps this is not surprising because it was the thing that kept them alive, the thing that means most to them is the suit. And again, maybe that's because that was the closest, it was the closest thing to them in a very literal way.
Well, I think it was the closest thing to them, as I talk about in the book, in a whole number of ways that are really rather beautiful and fascinating. I got to meet several of the Apollo astronauts when I was quite a few of them when I was a researcher at the Smithsonian, working with their amazing curatorial and conservation staff on the spacesuits there in Washington. But I didn't get to meet all these Apollo astronauts because they necessarily wanted to speak with a young architecture professor, but rather because they They don't actually go to the main, when they come to Washington, they don't go to this big cathedral of the National Air and Space Museum on the Mall, but instead out to this tiny storage facility in, I kid you not, Suitland, Maryland, where the suits are stored and conserved, and they come out there not just to visit the suits, but also to advocate for their care and make sure they're being well taken care of. And it goes beyond the fact that they were totally dependent on this object, because at various other times they were, of course, totally dependent on every part of the Apollo's architecture. But it also, I think, has to do with the kind of anthropomorphic quality of the suit. Neil Armstrong wrote this amazing letter to the suit makers on the 20th anniversary of the lunar landing, saying it was such an amazing object because it was tough, reliable, and cuddly. I think especially for Neil Armstrong to call something cuddly, you know, it must be a fairly strong emotion.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Nicholas DeMonchau. He is Assistant Professor of Architecture at the College of Environmental Design at University of California, Berkeley, and he is the author of the book Spacesuit, Fashioning Apollo, which tells the story of the development of the spacesuit, specifically the one that the Apollo astronauts wore, those that they wore on the way to the moon and to walk on the moon. And it is published, the book is published by the MIT Press. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, now I'm prompted to ask the question, as you mentioned the fact, and I mentioned the fact that you're an architect, you're a professor of architecture, you're an urban designer. So how is it that you came to write a book about the spacesuit?
Well, there's two answers to that question. There's the sort of intellectual story and the emotional story. The emotional story is, I think, like every 8-year-old in the world, I wanted desperately to be an astronaut. And so when I became interested, when I started studying architecture, I discovered that space architecture and spacesuits in particular had been inspirational and influential to a whole generation of architects in the 1960s and 70s to the present day. But interestingly enough, the spacesuits that had been most studied and written about by designers were not, in fact, these suits that had walked on the surface of the moon, but rather these kind of hard, armor-like prototypes that you mentioned at the beginning of the program. And so as I dug into it more, I tried to figure out why this might have been the case. And in many ways, it's because the Playtex spacesuit, as I write about in the book, defies a lot of our expectations about technological objects and human environments, and is instead of being designed from first principles, as architects are often inclined to do, it's literally and figuratively fashioned. That is, it's made. Not only does it use these kind of intimate expertises of couture and so forth, but it is also kind of made out of something else. It was made out of a girdle. It was made out of the innermost protective bladder of the suit. It was actually a combination of the girdle rubber that Playtex used until 1966. It was literally from the same vat as they were making girdles out of. And inside of it is a layer of this fabric called nylon tricot, which is what they make bras out of. Mm. And so it was these two things together, neither of which had been, of course, designed for use in outer space, that really gave the suit its incredible qualities, along with the other 20 layers of many different kinds of materials that helped protect and shelter that innermost bladder.
Yeah, that's again another one of the interesting things is that this new object, this novel object, was assembled from existing materials. These 21 different layers of fabric, they weren't things that were specifically invented for the space program or the spacesuit. They were things that already were sitting around that people said, well, you know, we need the suit to be able to do all of these different things, and here are different fabrics that will do things, so let's put them all together.
Right, exactly. And it was only one of the really interesting things about Apollo as a story is it was only really because of the enormous pressure that NASA felt under because of Kennedy's commitment to get to the moon by the end of the decade that this kind of adaptive approach to spacesuit making really held sway. It was had we had more time, things probably would have been designed more, as it were, from first principles, but probably in being less successful as a result.
Well, that's, again, another one of the, you know, the feature of the story is that the United, this was the Cold War. There was this intense competition going on between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Soviets were the first one to put a man into space. And so the United States government, this was at the time that John Kennedy was president, we were saying, okay, now what can we do to top that? And the answer was, well, we could put a human being on the surface of the moon and bring him back alive. That also was an important, not just get there, but get him back. We could do that. It would be expensive. We've got to put a lot of resources in it. We could do that. But once the decision was made to do that, then all sorts of things had to be invented that didn't exist before. We had to have something to send them in, and we had to have them something for them to wear, and we had all these problems that we had to solve because we suddenly had made this commitment to do this thing and then had to figure out how to do it.
Right. I mean, I think it's very easy when we look back. Gosh, it's now 40 years since we walked on the surface of the moon. It's very easy to look back and somehow equate the monumental character of the event in human history with some kind of slow, steady, monumental design enterprise. But instead, if you really think about it, the pace of the moon landing was, if we decided to go to the moon and without any of the technologies to do it in 1963, and we landed, in 2003, rather. It's a hugely compressed schedule, and so when you think of the scale of the enterprise, it was really incredible, incredibly rushed, and incredibly sized. In 1966, it took almost a nickel from every tax dollar, but it was judged to be worth it because not necessarily because of the scale of the heroic character of the event, but because it was a desperately urgent frontier in this central conflict of the 20th century, the Cold War.
Yeah, it's interesting if you take a look at even before we got into the era of space flight, as people imagined human beings going to other planets and what they would need to do that. You know, they had ideas about the protective clothing that they would have to wear. And it does, I think, again, if you take a look at it, many of these early ideas do look remarkably like a suits of armor. And trying to realize that then would become a very complicated bit of business when you're talking about joining these hard parts together to make flexible and yet airtight joints. So here, that was the idea. Now for spacesuits, but as far as the Air Force was concerned, that for some time there had been flight suits that pilots had used when they flew at high altitude, which were a completely different. They were kind of like wearing a rubber glove. You know, they were not like a suit of armor. They were like that. So, given that there was that model to work from, you know, why is it that there were people still thinking about the suit of armor when, in fact, we had practical experience with the rubber glove?
Well, I mean, David, that's a really interesting question, and it goes to, I think, a fundamental quality of talking about space, which is that space itself is a really interesting concept. It wasn't invented until Milton invented the term space as the area outside of the Earth occupied by angels and demons, and that's where we first find the word space used in that sense. And so space has this incredible otherworldly character. At the same time, at a practical level, space began to be defined in the 19th and 20th centuries as the environment that we need technology in order to enter. So for an aeronautical engineer, it's the altitude above which wings stop working. For a doctor, it's the altitude above which we need oxygen in order to survive. And so space has all these different definitions depending on the field, but fundamentally it is both this kind of celestial realm, this realm of gods, and then it is also the realm in which we need technology in order to enter. And so both those things, those threads of culture and kind of technology, combine to make space this kind of incredible black backdrop on which we project all of our both our fantasies and our aspirations and our ideas about technology and our relationship to technology. And it's through this, the mastery of this kind of empty waste that we master technology here on Earth. Or at least that's how I came to look at it in the as I started to write the book. And so you can't understand the discussion, for example, about how a man will enter space and walk on the moon without understanding all these deep urges and desires that that man is somehow going to be an angel or a god, and he's somehow going to be transformed by the technology that is going to take him there into that realm. And so somehow a rubber glove doesn't really fit that narrative.
Yes, I see. It's not. It doesn't have that nobility of the suit of armor, and perhaps also it's a it's a psychological idea that if you're going to be in this really hostile atmosphere, you want something. You want something, a hard shell around you, and the idea that even if there are 21 layers, if it's 21 layers of fabric between you and vacuum, maybe you're thinking, I'm not so sure about that.
Yes, you want something a lot less like a windbreaker and a lot more like a 1979 Mercedes.
Yeah, exactly so. Exactly so. Well, when were the early astronauts, I mean, how did they initially, when they were introduced to this particular vision of the suit, and maybe for them, they were used to wearing existing kind of flight suits, so maybe they didn't really think that was
They were certainly used to very constricting pressure suits. I mean, yeah. One thing that I would definitely want your audience to understand is that the fundamental problem of the spacesuit is not even so much a problem of protection. It's a problem of how to maintain this pressurized environment around the body. And so if you think of something like a basketball, when you fill it full of even just a little bit of air to be able to play basketball with it, it does two things. First of all, it's very hard and inflexible. And second of all, it wants to be round. If it wasn't round before you blew it up, it's certainly round afterwards. And so if you think of it, the human body, on the one hand, it needs to bend in all these different ways. And so this an inflexible kind of pressurized vessel is not very good for moving around. And secondly, it doesn't want to be round, especially the very sensitive parts of the body like the hand that always present the biggest problems for spacesuit designers. Your hand is very much not a sphere, and you need to move it in all these different ways. And so this is the design problem of how to maintain this pressure vessel around the body to allow it to move around and do work in space. And so the astronauts would have been used to constricting pressure suits, but these were mostly not pressurized. These were mostly kind of backups for in case their cockpit lost pressure in an airplane. And so actually doing work inside these suits became, especially at the very beginning, a very difficult prospect. When you mentioned rubber gloves, when the Gene Cernan made his spacewalk towards the end of the Gemini missions, he was wearing a suit that did not have the kind of cooling and ventilation properties of the Apollo spacesuit. And when he got down to the ground, the NASA technicians emptied almost a full bucket of water from each of the legs of his suit that he had just sweated out wearing this rubber suit and doing all the hard work of the spacewalk. And so it was they were really rather gruesome, uncomfortable things. And especially when the astronauts got into the ILC suit, they were really very much in favor of it because they just wanted something that worked. And they didn't very much care who made it, as long as it was made well and allowed them to do the work they needed.
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah, I think it's a great point to make that one of the challenges for the designers was something that because there was a great deal of because they were doing work, there was a lot of physical exertion involved, and it was really difficult for the astronauts. And for that reason, something that would provide them both the protection, but also would be comfortable enough and allow them to work in it. That was also a big challenge.
Right, and it was still very uncomfortable. I mean, many astronauts, for instance, lost their fingernails from the work. Not to be too gruesome, but from the work of bending the fingers of the suit in order to be able to pick things up. It's not. It's very much not like putting on a snowsuit or something. It's a very a difficult thing to do and a very difficult thing to wear. But the ILC suit was still not like wearing a down jacket on Earth. But it was much easier than any of the alternatives.
Yeah, I was also fascinated to to learn again if this history of the idea of the pressure suit as the rubber glove really goes back of quite a way, or at least it goes back to the earlier years of aviation, and that it was the brainchild of a very famous flyer, a man named Wiley Post, who was interested in, he wanted to fly at very high altitude, which meant that either the cabin of the plane had to be pressurized or he had to be pressurized. And he said, well, rather than pressurize the whole cabin, could somebody make him a suit that he could wear that would be pressurized? And in fact, it was the tire company, the B.F. Goodrich company, that actually made this rubber suit. And people can see pictures of it in the book. It looks sort of like what you could would imagine somebody wearing to do deep sea diving in.
Yes.
Would wear.
It had the same kind of helmet. Post asked B.F. Goodrich, or he actually approached them through his friend Will Rogers, the famous columnist, to make them what he called a tire in the shape of a man, so that he could. He had this old spruce plane called the Winnie Mae that was very fast, but by that time quite rickety. But he had Wiley Post was actually, as well as being a barnstorming pilot, he was the first to discover the jet stream, the very fast stream of air that moves above about 35,000 feet from west to east. And he was eager to use the jet stream to set a record for flying across the United States. He had previously set speed records for flying around the world as well. And so he needed to spend time up above 35,000 feet, but above about 37,000 feet, human blood boils at body temperature. So it's not the kind of place you want to be hanging out without some kind of protection.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Nicholas DeMoncho. He is assistant professor of architecture at University of California, Berkeley. We're talking about this history of the design of the spacesuit that the Apollo astronauts wore, the subject of his book, Spacesuit Fashioning Apollo. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Life is only on Earth, and not for long.
Kirsten Dunst stars in the new psychological drama, Melancholia, about depression and the end of the world. On the next Fresh Air, Dunst talks about making the film and working with the controversial director Lars von Trier. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with 10 different topics. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, it's a little bit of a switch, but in the first hour, we're going to take another trip to what we've been calling the Deep Archives, going back and re-airing some old programs. We've been doing this year to mark the fact that this program has been on the air 30 years. And the programs for tomorrow are both really conversations about what kind of society we'd like to live in and what kind of economic system would work best. One is from 1993, the other is from 1991. In the first, Robert Heilbronner, who was a rather famous economist known for writing about the lives of famous economists. We talked in 1993 about his book, 21st Century Capitalism, raising the question that people still raise about whether or not capitalism has a future. And then in the second hour, sociologist Robert Bella from 1991. We talked at that time about a book that he'd written entitled The Good Society, which tried to ask the question, well, what exactly does that mean? What would the good society constitute? So that's in the 10 o'clock hour. And then tomorrow we'll be back live in hour two, talking about Illinois politics with former Illinois Governor Jim Edgar, who is now a fellow in the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. So that's tomorrow. You can check up on the schedule by going to the website, will.illinois.edu. In this hour, the guest is Nicholas DeMoncho. He is an assistant professor of architecture at University of California, Berkeley, and is author of a recent book that is all about how it is that the spacesuit worn by the Apollo astronauts was developed. And the title of his book is Spacesuit Fashioning Apollo, and it's published by the MIT Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, you talked a little a bit earlier about, as people were thinking about going into space, the idea was, well, you know, how could humans do it? Because it was a hostile environment. And I'm interested in going back to the cyborg story. And there's a wonderful, in fact, you have here in the book, a reproduced page out of Life magazine with some illustrations of this idea that people were proposing, that for humans to be able to live and work in space, they would have to be altered in a way that you still read about it in science fiction today. You know, the idea that humans would be altered in various ways. And so this was from 1960. I would have bet money that I had seen this. I would have been 8 years old at the time and probably would have thought it was pretty cool. And it is still pretty cool somehow. I think that and obviously people are still toying with the idea. They still like the idea that somehow human beings could be augmented, reconstructed to give them super human powers, or at least the powers that humans don't have now. At the same time, it seems, I don't know, I'm not exactly sure how anyone could really have taken that seriously, even in 1960.
Well, that's a very interesting story in and of itself. That illustration in Life magazine was actually made by a quite famous science fiction illustrator named Fred Freeman. And I'm sure it lodged in a lot of people's consciousness. And nowadays we see it as more of a dystopian concept, like the Borg in Star Trek or something.
Yeah.
At the time, it was enormously optimistic. But one thing that it's really useful to understand about that term cyborg is it was actually invented not by what we would think of as classical technologists, but actually by a psychopharmacologist, a psychiatrist, and a researcher in analog computing, who are both based at the Rockland State Psychiatric Hospital, which is just north of New York City on the Palisades. And at the time, both the doctor, Nathan Kline, and the researcher, Manfred Kleins, two very similar names, they had been involved in the previous 5 years at Rockland State Hospital in the invention and discovery of the very first antipsychotic drug ever used to treat schizophrenia in the United States, and the very first MAOI inhibitor, antidepressant, used in the United States. And with these two drugs, they had actually succeeded in bringing, and the drugs that joined them from Europe, they succeeded in bringing out a revolution in psychiatric care whose scale can't really be underestimated. This massive deinstitutionalization, suddenly these ailments, these forms of madness that had plagued mankind for millennia had been mastered through modern technology. And so it was that sensibility that if only we could discover the right chemical and mechanical tools, we could make the body do anything. That when you think of it in terms of having, you know, mastered schizophrenia, or seemingly, you know, after so many hundreds and thousands of years of it plaguing humanity, it does seem a bit like you could do anything that you set your mind to with the human body, that the human body was going to be as susceptible to sort of systems engineering as every other part of the vast architecture of the space age.
You know, again, a really interesting part of the story has to do with repurposing of things. We talked about the fact that the United States, they decided we're going to go to the moon. And then they said, now, how exactly are we going to do that? Well, they needed things. They needed spacesuits. They needed capsules. They needed rockets. They already had some rockets that were made to deliver nuclear warheads. So they figured, okay, we can use those. We got rockets. And when they first started thinking, well, now we have to have something for the astronauts to wear, early on, as you say, the first spacesuits, they were there for an emergency, because those guys were not going to leave the capsule. And I think it's one of the interesting things here is you have a picture here of a suit that was worn by Alan Shepard. This was one of the early suits. And clearly what they did was that they had something that they already had, or they, you know, one of these earlier kind of rubber glove pressurized suits that we had talked about. But the thing was that apparently they didn't think it was quite sexy enough, so they sprayed it silver. Why silver?
Well, that's a really great story, and it illustrates one of the central themes of the book, which is that technology and culture don't exist separately from each other, as we often assume, but in fact are deeply engaged with each other in making the story of something like the Space Age. But the story is that it was actually a competing suit to that B.F. Goodrich suit that Alan Shepard wore, that was actually made by the same folks who made that first suit for Wiley Post. That had they got bumped from the cover of I believe it was Collier's magazine in the late 1950s with a prototype pressure suit, and they were very annoyed about this, and they were trying to think what they could do to make sure that this didn't happen the next time round. And David Clark, who was the head of the company that made these suits that and later the Gemini suits, and Scott Crossfield, who was a test pilot who was going to wear the suit, together hatched this plan that they would cover the suit literally in silver lamé, and that would make it look like it was a spacesuit, because, of course, Buck Rogers and all this sci-fi iconography had a lot of silver involved. And so when B.F. Goodrich was trying to compete, originally they actually tried to make the Mercury spacesuits gold so that they would be even more fantastic looking. And then they sort of defaulted to silver. What happened by the time the Gemini program came about, the suits were still silver, made by David Clark, but then when the astronauts needed to go outside the spacecraft, it was suddenly realized that silver was a terrible idea, because when you went out into the kind of unfiltered glare of the sun outside of the atmosphere, the silver became a kind of dazzling nightmare for the astronaut wearing the suit. And so it was at that time that the white fiberglass fabric that we see on the surface of the Apollo suits was used instead, and spacesuits became white. But then back on Earth in 1965, when the first white spacesuits appeared and appeared on everyone's televisions, all the Buck Rogers toys were actually all switched to being white instead, because then white became the kind of space age color. So it's this really interesting kind of dance between science fact and science fiction that goes back to the very root of the first spacesuit designs. Even the Wiley Post suit, only 5 or 6 weeks after it was first made, appeared in this Columbia Pictures science fiction film called Airhawks, in which Wiley Post himself appears to help battle a death ray wearing his B.F. Goodrich tire suit.
Yeah, it's great. I have a picture in here. It's really great. Yes, you can see Wiley and that suit. And again, it's as I said, it looks like those things that you would wear to go walking on the bottom of the ocean, because it has this big. It looks like he's wearing a tin can on his head that has a round porthole in it, so you can you barely just see enough of his face. And he wore an eye patch because he had lost one eye in an accident. So that's kind of how you can tell who it is.
Yes. Well. It looks like a tin can with a porthole, because that's what it is. So Wiley Post's flying career was actually started when he lost his eye in a mining accident, and he used the insurance settlement to buy his first airplane. So that eye patch is tied up in the story quite literally. And then when they designed the helmet for the suit, they realized that as they delivered oxygen into the helmet, they could actually aim the cold, pressurized oxygen over his eye patch so it wouldn't scorch any of his skin. And then they moved the porthole, to be centered on his one good eye. So it's a very, just like the Apollo suits, it was made very much for him.
The American space program, or really at least the Apollo program, was we did it because the Soviets one-upped us by being the first nation to put a man in space, Yuri Gagarin. So we thought, well, we can't let that stand, and so we decided we could go on one better by going to the moon. So they had rockets, they had space capsules, they had cosmonauts, and they wore suits. Was there anything interesting in the interesting differences in the way that the Soviet scientists approached this same problem?
Well, Soviet and American technological culture were totally different in a really interesting way. The Soviets, instead of having this kind of vast network of contractors and universities and manufacturers that had been built up through the 1950s, thanks to Dwight Eisenhower's investment in kind of technology as the strategy for America's defenses. The Soviet Union instead was as one might expect, centralized, but also in a way that was caused by the kind of astonishingly deprived and terrible circumstances of the Soviet Union in the 1950s, it was also enormously practical, practical to an extreme degree. So one example in suit design is that the Americans, we invested enormously in creating airtight zippers for suits. No one had ever invented an airtight zipper before, so there was a whole airtight zipper program in order to be able to zip people in and out of these spacesuits. Instead of worrying about airtight zippers, the Soviet Union just built the suit with a kind of a tube coming out of its chest that the astronaut crawled into and then put himself into the suit, and then this tube was tied in a knot and then clipped with something that looks like a bread bag clip to create the airtight seal. So it was this, you know, incredibly, you know, kind of astonishingly pragmatic enterprise.
Yeah. The I would expect that women today would not think of it this way, but I suppose for a woman who had ever worn a corset, a girdle would have thought to have been a great leap forward in terms of comfort.
Yes, it was called the living girdle, the Playtex girdle, because it lived and breathed with you, which it doesn't, from anyone who actually wore it, sounds like a horrible
indeed, so.
Experience, but probably better than a tight whalebone.
Than a whalebone corset, yeah. At least I would think that it would allow you to breathe a little bit better.
Yes.
Are there some ways in which, though, the revolution in fashion, particularly in these immediate post-war years, was connected with the developments of what have been referred to as foundation garments for women?
Oh well, I have a chapter actually. I should explain that the 21 different chapters of the book, they're not as kind of recapitulated by the spacesuit itself. It's not quite a linear narrative going directly from one chapter to the next, but rather a kind of an assembly of all these different stories which lead to the creation of this complex artifact. But one of these chapters or layers is about Christian Dior, because it was his kind of mastery of this streamlined feminine post-war silhouette that led to what was called the new look, which then came to serve as a kind of stand-in for all the many ways in which post-war American life was transformed. So that investment in technological R&D that Eisenhower made was called the new look in defense spending, and the revolution in psychopharmaceuticals I talked about was called the new look in psychiatry. And so it was this notion of new looks, that everything was suddenly changing after the war, that led to these very different ways of doing things, like the space race and like the way in which the space race in particular started out as a way to show, by sending astronauts up in the same rockets that we would use to deliver nuclear weapons, to show for the Soviet Union and the United States to show each other their mastery of ICBM technology. What came out after Gagarin's launch especially was that it was no longer just a kind of technological race, but it was really a race of media images. And so when Lyndon Johnson considered all the different options of how America could respond to Gagarin's launch, of course, one of his advisors was Jerome Wiesner, the president's science advisor, but another person was Frank Stanton, the president of CBS, because they understood that it was very precisely a kind of, it had gone beyond showing what you could do with your nuclear weapon rockets to, in fact, shaping the image-based reality of post-war life.
Yeah, they thought an important component of this whole thing was that an event that could be televised.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
When Alan Shepard was launched, Lyndon Johnson's comment, and there was pictures of him all over the world, the Lyndon Johnson's comment, because they were having difficulties with civil rights were, if only he were a Negro, because he knew that the power of that image in shaping global narrative.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, this detail. It was in the Kennedy administration that a decision was made to go to the moon, but the space program, the U.S. space program, really had begun earlier when Dwight Eisenhower was president. And he apparently felt the only direct sort of intervention that he made in terms of design of the program was, he apparently said, well, when we make these rockets, these rockets are very complicated things, and they're made of all these different parts, and their parts are made by different companies, and it all comes together in this thing. But that what he said was, this needs to all come together in enclosed in a single kind of a structure, which kind of hides the fact that it's this, all these different parts from all these different places. And it's just, it basically, it's going to say USA on it. That's all. It's not going to say Northrop Grumman or McDonnell Douglas or the individual, you know, nowadays, maybe right. Every part would, could, you know, you'd have naming rights for all the various parts. But at that point, he said, no, this is a unified effort. And what this represents is the United States. And that's all it's going to say.
Yes. And you can't really separate Eisenhower's very strong and I think correct stance on that issue from the larger narrative of the you know, what he was the first to call the military-industrial complex, which he explicitly created with his decision to fund technology versus a large standing army as a solution to America's post-war defense needs. But he was very, as came out in his last farewell speech, he was very wary of this enterprise as well. And he didn't want to give the military-industrial enterprise the credit for sending Americans into space. He wanted to give America that credit.
Just to we have maybe about 5 minutes left, and I want to come back to the women of Playtex, just because to give them their due. And in the first part of the conversation, we talked about how there was this competitive process that involved a division of Playtex that was set up to do government work, and that there had been competing companies and competing designs, and the one that was found to work best was the one that this Playtex company was doing, and the fact that then this suit with its 21 layers of material was hand sewn on Singer sewing machines by the same women that made the bras and the girdles. And I think one can't underestimate the technical challenges here and the remarkable work that was done by human hands.
Yes, I mean these were you know, right up there with the Apollo astronauts themselves, some of the most kind of moving and fascinating interviews I did for the book were with the seamstresses who had to sew to 1/64th of an inch tolerance, and mostly entirely without using any pins or fasteners to sew together 21 different layers, each slightly bigger than the next, like a kind of Russian doll, that all had to be inserted into each other, no wrinkles or crimps or anything like that, and then sewn together with, you know, hundreds of yards of seams in the whole object. Many of the seamstresses, because of the accuracy demanded, used a modified sewing treadle that only fired one stitch at a time. So just imagine crawling 1/64th of an inch at a time over these hundreds of yards of seams and not able to stray a 1/64th of an inch either side without ruining the whole object. It was just an astonishing achievement of craft and making.
And it must have really been, it must have weighed on them, the idea that here, you know, they were responsible for the lives of the astronauts in a sense, because that's, if the suit didn't work, then these guys, they'd be dead.
Yes, there was actually a little photograph of each astronaut in that traveled down the assembly line with their suit, just to keep in everyone's and the forefront of everyone's mind that a human life would be entirely dependent on the object.
Did the astronauts and the seamstresses ever meet?
Oh, the astronauts would go for fittings and adjustments at the factory. So yes, they would meet, and the women, you know, weren't just makers; they were also, in their own way, engineers. I mean, very few of the senior people at ILC were actually trained engineers. The head of the space program, a guy named Len Shepard, started his life as the television repairman of the company's CEO, and his chief lieutenant, George Durney, was a former Air Force pilot, but he'd been a sewing machine salesperson, was his qualification. And so there was a real exchange of very, very real knowledge about making that these guys, got, like George Durney and Len Shepard, would sit down with the seamstresses and really understand all the issues that came in pulling this object together, which was very different from the traditional engineering approach, where you sit down and draw something, and then someone, you know, an operator way down the line, produces something precisely to your specification. Mm-hmm. With the spacesuit manufacturing process, the drawings, which ILC was contractually obligated to to provide to NASA actually came after the suits were made.
Yeah.
They kind of sort of analyzed something after it had happened instead of, you know, kind of creating it like a traditional architectural drawing would.
Yeah. Well, just to finish up here, one thing that's I also think it's kind of striking is that even once we got into the era of the soft suit, and so these suits were being made and were being worn and had gone to the moon, that if you take a look at images of suits, though, that you see in popular culture, in popular media, things that were put on exhibit, things that were thought of as new designs, it seems that the hard suit was something that people just couldn't let go of. They kept at least as prototypes and as design ideas, people kept designing hard suits.
Well, I mean, a great example of that is the 1970 World's Fair in Osaka. The American Pavilion was full of space exhibits and moon rocks, but the final display was of these Litton RX suits that never went to the moon, but had been called RX because the head of the crew supply division at NASA had termed them the prescription or RX for how to put a man into space. And I think they fulfill much more traditional expectations about the kind of masculine, heroic quality of these hero astronauts in space. When those RX suits first came out, NASA put out a press release showing one of them literally standing next to a suit of armor with the caption, "Nothing new under ye old sun."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Our traditional cultural image of the astronaut is connected up with that kind of heroic warrior figure. And it turns out he's wearing, you know, a kind of modified girdle instead.
Yeah, I guess I go back to think was it Neil Armstrong who described the suits as tough and cuddly?
Yes, exactly.
I guess that's it. Maybe that's if you're an astronaut, you'd be okay with the idea that people would think of you as tough and cuddly, but maybe the more important part of the two would be the tough part.
Well, and not only that, but this goes back to the my point about how the suits resembled the astronauts in more than just softness. I mean, they were, with these 21 different layers, they were much more robust and resilient, much less prone to a kind of single failure than any kind of soft suit, which is much more like the way the body responds to the world and much less like how a car or an engineered object tends to be. And so this comes back to my interest in the subject as an architect, because what I believe we need to do, especially in our current historic moment, is not necessarily design things from first principles for a single purpose, but rather construct buildings and cities, especially, that have this same quality of softness, resilience, and an ability to kind of transform themselves to meet changing circumstances.
Yeah, well, the book is Spacesuit, Fashioning Apollo. It's published by the MIT Press by our guest, Nicholas DiMoncio. He's Assistant Professor of Architecture at University of California at Berkeley. Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was a great pleasure.